This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. There are increasing pressures to address energy usage here and around the world, and that has trickled down to Charlotte. UNC Charlotte has long been involved in efforts to innovate the way we build homes to be more energy efficient. And recently, a team of UNC Charlotte students spent 2 years focusing on smart design, taking into account equipment and technology as well as engineering, and the result was a smart home that they called Urban Eden. They were also among the 20 universities chosen to participate in the U.S. Department of Energy's Solar Decathlon 2013 competition. We've invited several of those involved to join us this hour to talk about how this competition and those like it are impacting our future. Dr. Mona Azerbaijani is Assistant Professor of Architecture at UNC Charlotte and Lead Principal Investigator of the Solar Decathlon Project. Investigator sounds impressive. Welcome to the program. Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
And also with us is Bobby Fornabio, an engineering student at UNC Charlotte. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Mike.
Clark Snell is a graduate student in the Master of Architecture program who has already written 2 books and numerous articles on alternatives to current construction methodologies and was the student project manager of the Urban Eden Smart House Project. Thank you for being here.
Excited to be here.
And Dennis Richter. I'll change your tune on that. and Dennis Richter is president of Narenco, the National Renewable Energy Corporation, and a member of the Urban Eden Steering Committee. He's also a graduate of UNC Charlotte's School of Architecture. Welcome back.
Thank you.
We have been hearing about solar technology, solar energy for homes and businesses for years. It seems to be taking forever to catch on. Is that because the technology isn't ready? It's not able to produce enough power yet? Is it because it's too expensive? Because it's not dependable? What's taking so long? I'm not sure who wants to take the answer.
Probably should take that one.
Go ahead, Dennis.
What's taking long is, you know, the cost of the technology has been relatively high. So it's just a matter of bringing the cost down to where it's affordable for most homeowners. And we're getting there very quickly. The technology is there. The technology is very simple and very effective.
If you wanted to replace the energy that you use in an average day, and let's just say you have air conditioning. Let's say it's an 1,800-square-foot house. You have air conditioning. You have a refrigerator. You have computers. You have televisions. You have lights, washer, dryer. How big an array do you need? How much would that cost?
That depends on how big of a house you have.
1,800 square feet. Let's make it 15 if that's easier for you to work with.
Well, I think we'll take this the solar house for example. I think you have a 7kW system, 7.5. So that would be the size system you would need to generate enough energy to run the house year round. So that would be, you know, it wouldn't be in any one day. It would just be throughout the year. It would generate enough energy to take care of all the needs of the home.
And that would cost me how much?
That would cost you
$10,000 to $20,000.
Yeah, 10 to 20. Something like that. Depends on where you are.
And what would I save? Get a little closer to that microphone, Doctor.
Sure.
What would I save? Because, you know, obviously the initial outlay, it's like building a generating station. It's going to cost a little more money. But over the course of using it, I'm not paying the electric company. So what would I save?
So it depends on how much electricity you use, like $100 per month or $200 per month multiplied by 12.
So that's what you would save your electric bill?
Yes.
Okay. Even on cloudy days?
If you have a battery, you can save, or if you're connected to the grid, you can feed the grid and use it on the cloudy days.
Does Duke Energy make it easy to feed the grid?
Sometimes.
Sometimes. Because I've heard that they put up – they don't really like this very much. They want you to buy it. Power.
They don't. They're definitely helping in the industry, but it depends on size system you have as to how easy it is to utilize the grid.
Well, one of the reasons for the solar decathlon that the university participated in was to prove that solar is practical at the domestic level, but when you take solar power to the level of the individual home, there are lots of other things to consider, it seems to me, like how it affects your neighbors, what it looks like. I'm hearing that there are pushbacks from neighborhood associations and from whole neighborhoods where they want to put these solar farms that your company, I think, helps to build. The Department of Energy Decathlon challenges collegiate teams to design and build and operate solar powerhouses that are cost-effective, energy-efficient, and attractive. How difficult is that?
It's not an easy thing to do. To take a regular house and put an array of
large glass panels on the top is it's a tough production to do. And then we went the next step and had the panels move on the house. So it's not a tough thing to do. It's definitely doable in the today.
You've been writing books about this and about solar power and engineering. Well, tell me how difficult it was to build this house and design it in a way. And I've seen the house. It really is interesting.
Well, I mean, I think that the thing that was difficult really was the big chance we took, which was the concrete that we used. And I'll be happy to talk about that ad nauseum in a minute. But I wanted to. I think that the secret, there was a great question that you asked initially, like how much it costs and how big the array is. The secret to this is efficiency of the envelope. In other words, the insulation around the inside of the building. So the better insulated, the better more airtight the building is, the smaller array you can use, and therefore the cheaper it is. So we really went with a very tight, very well insulated building first. Mm-hmm. And then that allowed us to make all the power we needed. We made way more power than we required at the competition.
They say that form follows function. I think that's what they say.
they do say that.
Did you take that? Does that dictate what the house looks like? Or
no? I mean, I think that the form and solar are completely separate, and I think that's an important point to make. The thing you said about the neighborhood associations; those associations also dictate the color of your house, mm-hmm. how tall your grass can be. So that's really a tough nut to crack. But in terms of how the house looks, I mean, you can make it look any way you want to. For example, Austria chose a team in the competition to completely hide their panels. You couldn't tell they had panels. Whereas we decided to celebrate them. And like Bobby said, they're movable. They're part of our shading strategy. We decided to, UNC Charlotte's a very modernist school in architecture, and we went with that direction, and I think it ended up being very successful.
I think Frank Lloyd Wright would like your house.
I agree.
Yeah, it kind of looks like a Frank Lloyd Wright house. Dennis, Narenko, your company, the National Renewable Energy Corporation, has begun construction in North Carolina on two solar projects, one in Warsaw, one in Mount Airy. Why those locations?
Well, we actually started construction on five of them. The one in Mount Airy is already complete. The one in Warsaw is on the eastern part of the state, and we have a total of five projects in Wayne and Duplin counties. And the reason that was chosen, those locations are chosen because of topography. Mm-hmm. It's flat. It makes it a little easier to build the system, less expensive. And also, at the time the projects were put together, Progress Energy, who services that part of the state, had a higher rate that they could pay for solar energy. So those are why that location was
chosen. These are solar farms.
These are farms, right.
In other words, the whole function of these arrays is to simply generate power. Where does the power go?
The power goes into the distribution grid. So it goes into the lines like you see in front of your house, the same lines that are out there.
Selling it to the power company or they own the array?
No, in our case, we're selling it to the power company. So we're really just a small power plant distributed over multiple locations.
How big are these projects in terms of the land mass?
Approximately 30 acres. Each project contains about 20,000 panels.
And they don't make any noise?
No noise, no moving parts.
So they just sit there?
They just sit there.
But I've read that in some places there's pushback to these things because people don't like the way they look. They also don't like windmills for some reason. It's odd to me, but have you gotten pushback?
We have not gotten any pushback on our projects, but there are some that have. I was just on a panel Friday, where the state organization NCSEA and the Solar Center out of NC State has put together a model ordinance for counties and municipalities to adopt across the state if they would like to, which would start to govern some of the restrictions they may want to see on solar farms, primarily visual, meaning if you locate a farm near a residential area, the neighbors may not want to look at it, although, it depends on your preference personally, whether you like the look of it or not, where they would have screening requirements and so forth.
The solar farms just look like the solar panels that we've seen on houses. They're just sitting on the ground, right?
Right.
And they're tilted toward the sun.
Correct.
What's wrong with that?
Well, it's personal opinion, of course, but if you're looking at the panel, it's quite pretty. It's blue, uh-huh. Kind of a sea of blue, but if you're looking at the backside, you're seeing the racking that holds the panel, and some people are opposed to that. So it just depends.
Why are you building these? Is there a demand to build these, or is this just the way you can make money by putting these things up and then selling the power?
Well, there's definitely a demand. I mean, that is why we build them. It's distributed generation, which means we're generating power close to where it's used versus transmitting it over, you know, several miles, sometimes hundreds of miles to get it to the location. And so we build them to put power into the grid at a better location where it's used. And it is a need. I mean, what we do is we produce power at peak. So when the biggest demand is in the middle of the day, typically in the summer. And by doing that, you know, we help reduce the need for additional power plants in the future, coal plants and so forth. So, yes, it's definitely helpful to the grid.
So your company is not alone. I read an article in the Charlotte Business Journal last week that there are a range of companies preparing to build large-scale solar farms in the state, with the per-watt price of those projects falling below $2 and often below $1.50. I'm not sure what that means, so I'm going to ask you to put those costs into perspective for me.
That is on a utility scale system, which is what we just talked about, 5 megawatt, 30 acres. That what that means is, well, you're trying to get the cost down to approximately $1 a watt, and that is what the Department of Energy has been trying to do, which is the same group, you know, organization that sponsors the House, to get solar down to $1 a watt. Theoretically, when it gets to $1 a watt, there's no more incentives needed from the federal government.
And when you say $1 a watt, that's what it costs to build the project?
That would be a total cost to build, finance the project. And when you hit about $1 a watt, the cost of that energy is about the same as a coal plant.
Really? It costs $1 a watt to build a coal plant?
Well, I'm talking about the energy that's generated from a coal plant. So when we get to $1 a watt, the cost of that kilowatt hour that we produce is similar to the cost to produce a kilowatt hour at a coal plant or a conventional power plant.
Now, interestingly enough, North Carolina ranks fifth in the nation in installed solar capacity and third in the nation for utility-scale solar capacity under construction. And what's more, North Carolina is the home to 4 of the 10 largest solar projects completed in the last quarter. How did that happen?
It happened quickly. It happened almost overnight. It happened in the last year and a half. But amazingly, and it occurred because of the policies that are in place in North Carolina. The state tax credit is one. Mm-hmm. The other is the avoided cost schedule, which is the rates that are paid to renewable energy producers. They are done in a favorable way in the state. They are set up in a way that companies can come in and know what they're going to get and the rules they have to play by. That happens nationally, but in North Carolina, there was a system that worked.
We seem to be in a good place in terms of energy because we've done a show a couple of years ago or maybe a year ago about wind power, mm-hmm. and that North Carolina is in the almost one of the places in the nation that's perfect for wind power because of the coastal air, the winds that come off the ocean. And now we're talking about being fifth or fourth or third in the nation with regard to solar power generation. Is there something about being in North Carolina that makes this good for solar?
Well, it's got good solar radiance, you know, compared to the rest parts, northern parts of the country. Not the best, not west is the best, but mm-hmm. I think it's the policies. You know, solar is still not at the point at the dollar a watt where it doesn't need incentives, and North Carolina has very good policies to promote it. And it's also one of the things I would note that while we're third or fourth in the nation, we're third and fourth with the distributed solar, meaning these little 30-acre projects all over the landscape, spread all over the state. The ones that are number 1, 2, and 3 are out west, and they've got hundreds of megawatt sites, thousands and thousands of acres, or more centralized.
That's Dennis Richter, who is president of the National Renewable Energy Corporation, along with Clark Snell from UNC Charlotte, Bobby Fornabio, and Dr. Mona Azerbaijani. We're going to come back and talk about the Solar Decathlon 2013 and the house UNC Charlotte built. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Charlotte Symphony, presenting Bachtoberfest, featuring music by Bach, Wagner, and others, plus beer sampling, German displays, and more, Friday, 7:30, in Knight Theater. Tickets at charlottesymphony.org. And Fisher & Phillips, LLP, a national labor and employment law firm, representing employers in North Carolina from the Charlotte and Columbia offices. Partner Kevin Dalton and Fisher & Phillips on the web at laborlawyers.com. Life in prison is a life-altering experience, but the residual effects of that prison stay are sometimes just as difficult as the time spent in a cell. And this can be especially true for women who are also trying to care for a family or to keep one together. There are some local folks who are trying to change all of that, and we meet the founder of an organization that empowers women and helps them with their lives after prison tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm show, the recent shutdown and debt ceiling crisis that paralyzed Washington prompts new questions about polarization of the U.S. electorate, congressional district boundaries, demographic patterns, and prospects for moving beyond gridlock in Washington.
Join that conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the solar energy and the house that UNC Charlotte built for the Solar Decathlon 2013, which is a contest, a competition. Please, no wagering. Sponsored by the U.S. Department of Energy. Dr. Mona Azerbaijani was the lead principal investigator of the Solar Decathlon. She is with us along with Clark Snell, who is a student project manager, Bobby Fornabio, who is an engineering student who worked on the house, and Dennis Richter, who is a former student there many years ago. Well, not many years ago, but long enough to become president of Norenco, which is why he's here today. We were talking about getting these vast, these big utility-size solar arrays down to $1 a watt, which makes them comparable in productive capacity to a solar plant, a coal-powered plant. That's at the utility level. What do you have to do to make it competitive at the home level?
I think the way to look at that is when you do it on the utility scale level, you're paid a lower rate for the power because it's wholesale. Mm-hmm. But when you do it at a home, you're exchanging it. So whatever you might pay at your home, 10 cents a watt or whatever that might be, is what you're getting also because you're net metering against the retail rate of the utility grid. So it makes it so that you don't necessarily have to get to $1 a watt on a residential system because you're getting paid more for the power you produce.
I should have asked this question when we were talking about what it costs to install an array on your house that is powerful enough to supply your electricity needs on sunny days. At what point would you pay that back? In other words, how many years does it have to be in operation before now you're really getting power for free?
And the cost has been dropped since, if you look at the past few years, the cost of the photovoltaic cells has been dropped dramatically. But still, the payback for the system that you're buying is 10, 20 years, which is the life cycle of these PV panels. And you are getting the energy for free in this 10, 20 years. You don't pay any electrical bills. But still, you have to maintain it, and also you need to buy it again after 20, 30 years.
What happens to it? Why does it go bad after 20 years? There are no moving parts. It just sits there in the sun.
Yeah, that's the life cycle.
The solar cells degrade over time. So, 20, 30 years is the expected life, but they'll really go on for 100 years or more because they degrade every year.
How does the U.S. compare to other countries in terms of its development of its adoption of solar power?
That's a really good question. We're way behind, definitely in terms of Europe. I think that Germany now has a law that by 2030 they're going to have 80% of their power.
And is that because they have now rejected nuclear power, which they were really keen on until Fukushima?
This was going on well before that, and you could get into a big analysis of why there's a smaller country. They don't have access to a lot of resources. But the fact is that they have committed to renewable energy in a way that we have. And I think we're at, 0.5% or something like that
now? Because didn't we develop the solar array technology and kind of give it up to Japan or the Far East to let them – they now produce the panels and we don't?
Yeah, we were talking back in the space program. I want to jump into the house for a second if we can because, again
– I'm going to get to the house. I know you're gung-ho on the house, but go ahead and talk about it.
Well, because really what we're beating around the bush here, like I said before, the secret to this, you're asking specifically in residential, is the building that you design. If you design a building – this is another place that Europe is way in front of us. And by the way, there were two European entrants in the Solar Decathlon. They got first and third. So I think that – is another indication of sort of where we are and that we need to sort of step it up. But if you the basic strategy is you design a building that needs very little power, and therefore you need a small array and you can afford it. And also an important point to make is the building itself is a thing that can last a long time. So you have all these technologies that change and that degrade, but the building, your insulation, your walls, the basic structure of the building can last hundreds of years. So that's what you...
Well, we're going to talk about this building because this building really is designed to be rock solid and tight and completely energy efficient. But if you took a solar array like the one that you put on the building that you designed for the Decathlon and put it on a previously constructed house that perhaps is not as rock solid, I know mine isn't, would it power the home? Or are you just wasting electricity?
We had a very large array on that. Yeah, I think you, and that's what Dennis was saying. I think you could power an 1,800 square foot house with that array. But that array is much larger than it needed to be for a house the size that we have.
Now, solar energy is clean. It does not produce pollutants in the production of electricity. But what about the manufacturing of the photovoltaic cells themselves? Is that a pollution-free process?
It's still not 100% pollution-free, no.
It's the manufacturing process.
They're catching up.
Is it overly polluting the atmosphere when we make these panels, or is it a wash once it's done and we don't have to burn coal to produce electricity?
Well, there's multiple studies about that, but constructing a panel is really no more polluting than constructing any other good that we use on a daily basis. It doesn't create any toxic waste that makes it special, makes it stand out.
So the university was in competition with 19 other universities and entities around the globe. How were you chosen to be part of this competition, one of the 20?
We started 2 years ago. First, Department of Energy asked for put a proposal out, and these 20 schools, or 100 schools around the world, they put proposal to the, they write a proposal to Department of Energy. We started 2 years ago. We wrote a proposal, and it got accepted along the 19 other schools, and around 100 other schools have applied to the program.
So just being in it was a kind of a victory.
Yes, and the Department of Energy gave $100,000 to each of these schools to start the project.
It's a lot of money. What did you do with all that money?
Spent it.
Good. Thank you very much. Because it's student labor, right? It's student genius. It's student and some faculty help as well, obviously. But that all went into materials for the house because this turns out to be a house. One could buy this house and live in it.
Correct.
Right?
It's a student-led project, this solar decathlon competition. It's a student-led project with help of advisors and faculty and steering committee. But we need to raise money for the rest of the cost associated with the construction of the house and also other costs.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the materials have been donated, and we have a sponsor who gave us in-kind and cash to build this house.
Mm-hmm. How many students on the project the actual building of this house, in on the design and building of the house?
Well, since we had 2 years, there was turnover, or every semester was different groups. So I think there was maybe 70 students total over time. We had 20 or 30 at different times out at the actual competition. So it was a huge effort, and it was interdisciplinary. We had engineers, architects, some people from communications and other departments.
And the charge from the U.S. Department of Energy was to build a house that was practical in its design, correct? So how do you take that? How did you take that directive and come up with what you came up with?
Well, I don't know if you've ever hung out with many architects, but it's definitely like herding cats. So it's an amazing thing that we sat down, we had a bunch of charrettes. We got together with initially with people from a bunch of different departments and talked about what we thought the house should be, and it took a long time to come up with a concept that everybody agreed upon, but when we did, we basically came up with the idea that we wanted to design something for Charlotte, an infill project. I live in Third Ward. I live in an old 1920s house. I can walk to Panther Stadium in 3 minutes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So something for that kind of – you can still do infill in Charlotte. Then we asked ourselves what we didn't like about living downtown if we did live there, and it was that there wasn't enough access to nature. So we decided to design a building that had – basically an indoor and outdoor space that was equivalent. And it was sort of amazing. When we came up with that idea, everybody agreed with it.
Hmm. And this was an effort by people from many different disciplines. It wasn't just architecture students or engineering students. How many different disciplines were involved in this?
three main colleges, College of Arts and Architecture, College of Engineering, and College of Business. And within those, like College of Engineering, there were mechanical engineers, building technology, and electrical engineers.
We got the civils. We had a concrete house made with the geopolymer.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Brett Tempest from the university kind of founded that technology, and yeah, we brought a concrete house to the competition, so thanks to the civils.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about this, but the competition was in Irvine, California. You had to take this concrete house across the country and back. We'll talk about how you did that, but where are you in school, Bobby?
I'm in my senior year here at Charlotte.
Okay, and you got involved in this project when?
From the very beginning of the project, actually, when they were doing the they had a little series of lectures that the College of Architecture was putting on.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of the engineering professors were doing some of the lectures, too, about PV and the future of the technology.
PV is
photovoltaic. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I've been on from the beginning, and just a really captivating project.
What do engineers do? What did engineers do on this project?
Yeah, Bobby.
Everything that the architects didn't do. Really just they designed all the electric layout of the house, all the wiring. I don't know if they picked out the appliances.
The appliances by architecture.
But really just got the house to work, I'd say.
Now, decathlon, if I know the word correctly, means 10.
Ten competitions.
Ten competitions. Contest. What were the 10 competitions? What were the 10 charges that you had to?
The hot water we had to do, you have to demonstrate that your house is capable of producing hot water for, you know, your daily usage.
Thermal comfort, appliances. There were five jurors, contest, architecture, engineering, market appeal, communication, and
Affordability,
and the other was task contest, hot water, appliances, thermal comfort.
And by hot water, let's be clear about this. This does not mean going out to Lowe's and buying a hot water heater and sticking it in the house. The house has to be able to produce through some way hot water. Is that correct?
Well, we had a hot water heat pump, so it was not typical, but it was still a heat pump that used power. Some people use solar thermal, which is where you just heat a liquid by the sun, but we decided not to do that because basically PV has gotten more efficient, and we crunched the numbers and decided it was a better way of going.
Rather than putting flowing water on an open tank on the roof that takes the sun's rays and heats the water and puts it in the tank below the house, which is how it's been done for 25, 30 years now, you're using the photovoltaic cells to run a hot water heat pump, which is an air conditioner in reverse, kind of, to heat the hot water because it's actually more efficient than heating the sun, using the sun to heat the water.
There's a fairly long technical explanation for that, but I mean, basically, yes, that's what we decided to do.
That the water heater used on the house actually was pretty innovative. It had a heat pump on it, so it would take the latent heat out of the air and actually air condition the air in the mechanical room for us, so it would get colder as you're standing in there. And so at the same time, the water's heating up with the same heat. So
we're not heating the water. We're pulling heat out of the air to heat the water.
I got to tell you, I have a heat pump, and I don't understand how it works. So I don't want to know because I'll never understand it. The decathlon also promotes whole building design. Is that the best way to make the most efficient use of solar technology, really to start from the design and the ground up and build a house that is designed to be a solar house?
It's the only way to do it. Not really. I mean, you know, and I think we decided early on also not to focus on the bells and whistles, which we had some really cool bells and whistles, but if you don't start with a building that can deliver a low heating, cooling, and plug load, then you're just you're wasting your time. And that's really would be the barrier to entry that you're talking about before is just the size of these systems and trying to power inefficient buildings, which is what we basically have in our building stock right now.
Sustainability is a big thing in this house. Not only the sustainability of the way you generate electric power and heat water, but also from the materials you used in the building of the house. Explain that.
Concrete? Is that what we're going to talk about? Yeah.
If you want to talk, you're really excited about concrete. So no. What the heck? We've never done a show on concrete. Let's talk about it.
Well, no, I mean that. I can't say enough what a big deal it is that we accomplished that. And
all right, let's go back because people didn't know this. I don't know this. I didn't know it till yesterday. Concrete, the manufacturer of the normal kind of cement that we see everywhere, Portland cement, actually is a polluting process.
Oh yeah.
Didn't know that.
The number we've been using is 8% of the carbon footprint worldwide is from Portland cement concrete.
Why?
Because you burn limestone at very high temperatures in a kiln, and so you're using a lot of fuel and carbon. You know, when you burn fossil fuels, you let off carbon dioxide. But also, as you burn limestone, the chemical reaction creates carbon dioxide. So it's just incredibly carbon intensive. And since carbon dioxide is really the central cause of human-induced climate change, then Portland cement is a big factor. Now, you can't – one reason is we use so much cement because it's such a great product. So should we just jump into that?
Well, I was going to say that you developed a different kind of cement. You developed this geopolymer cement. Did you know that you could do it when you decided to build the house out of cement? Well, or did you kind of develop that as you went along and have a eureka moment?
No, this is a uniquely Charlotte story. So we have at UNC Charlotte – there is a joint studio between architecture and engineering.
Mm-hmm.
So the architecture professor is Thomas Gentry, and the engineering professor is Brett Tempest. And the studio is sponsored by the Precast Concrete Institute, so it's a concrete studio.
Mm-hmm.
And Brett Tempest has been doing research on this geopolymer cement since graduate school, so he is one of the experts in the world on this technology. And so through this studio, we had access to this. And what we did was take it from the lab into a building. And as far as we know, it's the first time in the world that that has been done. And so it took a huge amount of effort. First, we had to do a lot of test pours and try to figure out how you can finish the material, because it really had never been in Brett's lab. It was just that they made things and broke them to see how strong they were. But let's go back to the house. So we basically had this urban building, and we decided to use concrete. If you look downtown Charlotte, it's mostly precast concrete.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great material for urban reasons because, you know, it's a sound barrier. It's very durable. It was part of our heating and cooling strategy. One of our goals when we started was, like you said, to be sustainable. And if you're going to be sustainable right now, you have to be thinking about climate change, in my opinion. So we really couldn't use typical concrete. So we started looking around. We realized this technology was at UNC Charlotte, and then we took the plunge and decided to go for it.
And what's different about your concrete? It's geopolymer, but what does that mean?
It's a different chemical, basically. It's geopolymer is an aluminous silicate. In our case, it's fly ash, which is a waste product of coal combustion, but it could be clay. And then there's a couple activators. So you're just mixing things that are existing. You're not having to burn anything. You apply some heat, and it hardens like Portland cement concrete. And that's really the amazing thing, is that it looks and performs, probably tastes like Portland cement concrete, but it's has this huge reduction in carbon footprint. About 90% is what we're saying.
And you didn't stop with just having concrete walls. We're going to talk about what's in those walls in a second. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Christmas Made in the South, a fine arts and craft festival featuring the works of over 300 artists and master craftsmen. Cabrera Serena, Friday through Sunday, madeinthesouthshows.com. And PNC Wealth Management, with over 160 years of experience and a team of financial professionals committed to helping clients achieve their financial goals. More from Jennifer Green at 704-686-2129. Well, the recent shutdown and debt ceiling crisis that paralyzed Washington prompts new questions about polarization of the U.S. electorate. Diane Rehm and her guest will be along to discuss congressional districts, demographic patterns, and prospects for moving beyond gridlock in Washington at 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to talk about solar power generation and electric efficiency and home building efficiency, now's your chance at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks, and we're coming right back. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte Talks is celebrating 15 years on WFAE, and to mark the occasion, we are hosting a special evening with best-selling author of the Bones book series, Kathy Reichs. Join us November 6th at 7 p.m. at Spirit Square's McGlowan Theater and be part of our studio audience. And after our special show, stay for an anniversary dessert reception. Go to WFAE.org for ticket information and more details, or call 704-372-1000. Hope to see you there. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins in our Spirit Square studio. Dr. Mona Azerbaijani, who is a professor of architecture, assistant professor of architecture, and lead principal investigator for the Solar Decathlon 2013 competition that UNC Charlotte designed and built a revolutionary house when you come right down to the materials they built it with. Clark Snell was the student project manager of the Urban Eden House. Bobby Fornabio is an engineering student who worked on the house. And Dennis Richter is president of the National Renewable Energy Corporation. If you'd like to see pictures of this house, and you really should, because even if we get down into describing it into detail, you will not be able to understand what we're talking about. We have a picture. We have put pictures of the house on our website at wfae.org/charlottetalks, and there's a link to the UNC Charlotte website from there, so that you can see this thing in operation, because it moves. Things on it move. Going back to the geothermal cement, you were just talking off the air, Clark, about how this thing cost, you spent about $1.5 million or more on this house, but for that money, you've kind of developed a whole new product that didn't really exist for building purposes before, and very few organizations could produce a new product for that little bit of money.
Exactly. And we used the infrastructure that we had and the fact that we already had this thing going in the university, and It's world-changing what we accomplished. I mean, it's amazing. And I was, you know, I've told this before, but I was laying under the house at one point when we were trying to put it together out there, trying to figure out how I was going to explain that we didn't get it together. We were very close to not getting it done because it was so much work to do this. It's a 250,000-pound building that we dragged across the country. Mm-hmm. But we did it because this is the venue to do it within. You can't – if you wanted to go out and build that house right now, you wouldn't have been able to do it before we did that. You know, we had to show that it was possible, and we had to do it in a high-profile way, which is what the Solar Decathlon is about.
Because now this, the concrete walls, we've already talked about in urban construction, concrete is durable, it's strong, it has noise cancellation properties, it insulates the house from the outside noise, etc. But it also, in this house, acts as a heating cooling barrier. It's the envelope. But inside the concrete walls are a series of tubes that also help heat and cool, stabilize the temperature of the house, correct?
Correct.
Is that a revolutionary concept,
yes,
too?
Yes, it is. What we're doing, it's basically called hydronic heating and cooling, and that's not new. But what we tried to accomplish was basically a type of cooling where we didn't need to use a refrigerant. In other words, we didn't need to cool the wall itself. We could just pull heat out of it. And we did that by, because we had so much concrete, so there's all this surface area of concrete, and then these little tubes in the walls have a lot of surface area also, and they were connected to heat exchangers on the roof, which also have a lot of surface area. So basically we have a very efficient heat transfer medium, and so we pumped water through those tubes on a hot day. I mean, well, basically after the sun goes down, so during the day the concrete's sucking up heat from the air, and basically that's what it does. It's always going to take on more heat than the air around it, so it is going to lower the heat in the summer of the air inside. But it's storing that heat, so you have to do something with it at night or you won't be able to do it again the next day, so you have to get rid of it. So what we did was pump water through these little tubes to heat exchangers on the roof to dissipate that heat. And if you're basically at night, you're through radiation, you're exposing these tubes to these heat exchangers to the night sky. Even, so basically it's a very efficient heat transfer. It's basically 0 degrees Kelvin in space.
Even on a hot night, the heat can dissipate from those?
It's really about the atmospheric conditions that you have it. So if it's a really clear night, the heat gets sucked out from the atmosphere really quickly. For example, in your car, when you get in it in the morning and you have a little frost on your windshield, that's just because it wasn't a clear night, yeah. But night you get out there and it's really cold, it'll freeze up.
But in Charlotte, it can stay hot in the middle of July or August at night. I mean, and the house can still dissipate its own heat.
So because we're dissipating by radiation, mm-hmm. not so it's not through the air. Mm-hmm. You know, the sun heats the earth by radiation. It's not going through air, right? So by the same principle, we're releasing it to space, basically.
So having to take this house, build it here, take it apart, truck it across the country for the competition in Irvine, California, put it back together, have it judged, take it apart, bring it back across the country to Charlotte. Did that limit what you could do? If you had just built it on site and let the judges come to you, could you have done more?
Definitely. It was such a challenging process it's not easy task to just put these modules, four different modules together. It's, you know, one day we were just trying to put one canopy roof on the north side of the house. It's, you know, if it was just the house that was sitting here, definitely we mm-hmm. didn't need to go through all these challenges, how to take it apart, how it goes back together, what are the also the limitation of the transportation, how wide it's going to be, each of these modules, what is the length of it, all those would have been disappeared.
It really turned out to be a learning experience because, I mean, it's really nothing that anyone's ever done before, ship a house across the country, but we just ran into problems left and right. I mean, the whole summer we had down here in Charlotte, the rain in the beginning, that really set us back. And then luckily when we got out to California, there was no rain, but I can only imagine we would have got set back even further if there was rain. The conditions of the build definitely affect.
This was described by somebody as being a life-changing experience for the participants.
It's definitely a once-in-a-lifetime experience to get out there on the airstrip in Irvine and see all the other teams and all their, you know, they all have their own shirts and they're all coordinated. It's really a once-in-a-lifetime thing.
Now, Clark, your background is in low-tech, high-performance building systems for residential construction, and you've written books and articles on industrial construction techniques. How different are the techniques those techniques from what you did in the Urban Eden House project?
Well, I started out really in what's called natural building, mm-hmm. so basically trying to use things that are available on site or close by. This has been a progression for me, so it's very different in this way. We use precast concrete. You can go to any city in the country and order precast concrete panels. So this is something that is widely applicable. You don't have to be an eco warrior to do it. So that's the difference, and that's why I'm doing this, because we can apply this right now to any building in Charlotte.
Mm.
And that's a huge, that's just to me, it's blowing my mind.
It's the cost comparison. If you can go out and buy a precast slab of concrete and use it in the construction of a house versus having you guys come out and say, well, here's our geopolymer concrete, what's the cost difference?
I got to make a plug too, by the way. So our sponsor locally was Metromont, and they're a precaster, and they were incredible. We basically just went to their plant and did this and showed that you can do it with an existing facility. And they supported us all along the way, and mm-hmm. It was a real success story. But as I said, this is the first building we know of in the world that's using this technology, so we don't know the price. But what we're talking about is 100% fly ash, which is a waste product, and two chemicals. So it's a known quantity, and I personally believe it's going to be cheaper than Portland cement concrete.
So now, if you're building a house that is solar and not taking power from a coal-burning power plant, and you build enough of these, that'll put the coal-burning power plants out of business. There won't be any fly ash for the cement.
Well, that's why geopolymer is
a good problem.
Amazing technology because it's not – you don't have to use fly ash. Basically, you need an aluminum silicate, and there are types of clay that are aluminum silicates. You can use burnt rice husks. So it's a regional material. You can have regional solutions.
Okay. Now, architecturally, it's not just a concrete house. It's a very modern house. Could you have designed this house and made it look like a Georgian or a colonial or something else?
Not even in Charlotte.
The walls the way they were set up. Not with the wall.
But couldn't you have slapped something on the outside, like, I don't know, siding? or made the concrete look like brick?
If you look at our facade, we made sure that we we wanted to have some kind of articulation on it to show that you can do that. And if you go look at the Precast Concrete Institute, you'll be amazed at what you can do with concrete. I mean, you can make it look like whatever you want, definitely. That's what, you know, concrete, the reason we're 8% of our carbon footprint is because of concrete, is because it's such a great material. It's a poured-in-place rock. You can shape it any way you want.
Now, you've situated the house so that the whole back wall, the southern-facing wall, which is the area that gets all the sun, is glass. How do you – it's like living in a fishbowl. How do you make it not living in a fishbowl?
The PV panels is a movable PV panels that slide out and provide shading for the south glass wall. It's basically not just generate energy for the house, the PV on the roof, but also it has another function.
So the photovoltaic panel, something I cannot say very well, in the summertime, you could slide those out over the overhang that's next to the glass wall and shade the glass wall. But in the wintertime, you can retract those panels.
Correct.
And the sun can come flooding in to help heat the house in the wintertime.
The other big thing is the Eden part. Is the we have, like we said before, so we have a 822 square foot interior square footage, and then we have 800 square feet outside of that. Mm-hmm. And the glass wall you're talking about, really in our mind, is separating, is a transition between those two spaces that are connected. So you have an incredibly beautiful outdoor area that's completely surrounded in plants. It's basically, there's a roof, which is the steel structure that holds the PV. There are walls, which are the plants, and there are even windows, which are openings above the plants. And so it's a private outdoor space.
And the house collects rainwater, which can then be used to water those plants.
Exactly.
It's a vertical garden.
Yes.
Correct.
It goes up.
Yes. And you really, I mean, that was another amazing...
7 foot tall.
7 feet tall. Okay. Yeah.
So I think largely on the strength of the geopolymer, we got third in engineering, but we also got first in people's choice. And over again, as people walked in this house, they gasped looking at the Eden part. You have to experience it to know what it's like.
Okay. Yeah, there was when we were given the tours of the house, there was a spot on the back at the exit of the house, and as people were leaving, we were giving them little stars, and we had a little sign set up, and we were asking them what their favorite feature of the house was between the moving panels, the capillary tube system, and the walls. And the majority of people seemed to like the vertical garden in the back. Just the sense of privacy you get from it was unrivaled.
Also, the building products within, there's a lot of wood in the house. There's a lot of the wood flooring in the house. There's the what else?
It's actually treated ash for the flooring, and also the lambu, which was the siding for the outside of the wet core, as well as the inside material.
And some very interesting design elements. You've got a flat screen TV mounted in this wall, which you just look at if you want to sit there and watch television. But you can also open that whole wall up so that the TV is then exposed to the outside, so you can sit outside and watch your TV. And when you open that wall up, there's a, surprise, Murphy bed behind it, which becomes your guest room.
Mm-hmm. The furniture in the house was really unrivaled in the competition, because none of the other teams had made any of their furniture, their cabinetry. The students on the project made all the cabinetry.
You didn't just go down the street to IKEA.
No,
and buy
the amount of time spent on the cabinetry was really impressive, and the final product was just phenomenal with the lambu facing. It really, really all
lambu is
blended
what? Bamboo and what?
Laminated bamboo.
Okay. Why did you choose to build the furniture? Seriously, a lot of it does, it's very modern, so you could have gone to IKEA. It's right down the street from you guys. Why did you choose to build it?
It just fits in the house better. It's all custom. It's just...
There's one feature that I thought is really cool, and that you have this, what appears to be a kitchen island where the cooktop is. But on the other side of that island, you have these little stools, and people put stools on the other side of their island. But if you move the stools out, underneath that island is the dining room table. You just pull it out.
That was also built by the students.
Who designed that?
It was basically a group project collaboration between the students. Though since it was 800 square feet, we wanted to have this adaptable feature that we can use the small space for all the functions that we would like to have in the house, having a guest or having 8 people sitting around the table and having dinner.
Now, it's 800 square feet out, 800 square feet in. Could you have made it 1,500 square feet, 2,000 square feet, 2,500 square feet? Could you have done that?
Definitely. I mean, if you look at the design, there's basically a corridor on the south side by the glass wall you're talking about, and it goes straight through the bathroom. So you could just keep adding rooms along that corridor to make the
How many more panels, electric panels, photovoltaic panels would you have had to add?
Well, I don't think you need any, really, because, like I said, we made way more power than we needed.
Greg emails, how do solar panels withstand hailstorms? Hmm.
They are laminated glass, much like your windshield, so they are very strong and withstand hail.
And Jay says, please rate the competition from other universities. Which ones have traditionally done well at these events? I frequently pass the headquarters of the ASU Solar Decathlon Group in Boone. How was their design?
They actually got People's Choice Award, too. Okay.
Well, in 2011. They weren't in this competition.
Who won?
Austria.
And why?
Well, you know, there was the juried competitions, that's always subjective. And I think, there was a lot of question as to why certain houses were chosen for that. But I think Austria, first of all, they were very innovative. They did well in all the measured competitions, and they just had it together.
They were very out of the box.
What did you learn from the other competitors that you can now go back and apply to this? Or can you?
What did we learn?
You know, to be really honest, when you're in the competition, you're constantly busy. And so I am going to spend more time later looking at the houses online than I probably spent there.
What happens to this house now in 10 seconds or less?
We are bringing it back to the campus, mm-hmm. and it's going to be used as a lab to look at the performance of the house over time. So it's coming back of the
Dr. Mona Azerbaijani is the Assistant Professor of Architecture, Lead Principal Investigator for the Solar Decathlon 2013, the People's Choice Award winner from UNC Charlotte, Clark Snell, Student Project Manager for the Urban Eden House, Bobby Fornabio, who is an engineering student who worked on the house, and Dennis Richter with Narenko. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.